Hi, I'm Jessica, and when I'm not drinking all the coffee, watching Razorback sports, or hanging out with my family of boys, it's my passion to help elementary music teachers just like you find your unique teaching style. My goal with this podcast is to share helpful tips, strategies, and to give you the motivation you need to gain momentum in your teaching so you can continue being the music teacher rock star you already are. Welcome back to the Elementary Music Teacher Podcast. You're listening to episode 79. Today is a conversation with the amazing Matthew Stensrud. You may know him better as Mr. S. Orff all over social media and his website. Today we're going to be talking about the responsive classroom and movement in music. When it comes to the responsive classroom, a lot of times most of the trainings, whether it's a meeting at your school or a book you've read or an article online, a lot of it just pertains to the regular classroom teacher. And so I love this conversation because he currently does the responsive classroom method in his own music classroom. He shares amazing strategies and tips that you can implement today into your own classroom as well. Also, he is very knowledgeable about movement in the music room and currently does so much movement with his own students. And so if you're hesitant about getting started with movement and music and you're not really sure what exactly to do when, he has so many tips and ideas that your students will love and that you will feel more comfortable teaching movement with your students after today's episode. So who is Matthew? He's an award-winning elementary music and movement teacher. He currently teaches pre-K through 4 music and movement in Washington, D.C. He received his Master's of Music Education from George Mason University and his Bachelor's of Music Education from the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music. He's an Orff Schulwerk approved teacher educator of movement and teaches movement levels courses in South Carolina and Oregon. He's also on the Orff Echo editorial board and was a key content contributor to the book Responsive Classroom for Music, Art, PE, and other special areas. He presents workshops internationally and is also well known on social media, like I said, as Mr. S. Orff. So let's go ahead and go right into today's conversation with Matthew Stensrud. All right, everybody, welcome back to the podcast. As you heard in the intro, we have Matthew with us today, and I'm so excited to talk to him about the responsive classroom and movement in the music room. And so without further ado, Matthew, I'd love for you to just introduce yourself a little bit more to the audience, and I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you, Jessica. It's an honor to be here. Yeah, everyone, my name is Matthew Stensrud, and this is my 10th year of teaching elementary music. I taught in 2 different public schools previously, both in Fairfax County and Alexandria City, which are public schools in Northern Virginia, outside the Washington, D.C. area. And now I'm in my first year at Sidwell's Friends School, which is a Quaker school up in D.C. So it's really kind of fascinating to have the lens of a independent school as well as a Quaker school and have a lens as a brand new teacher. Because even though you've been teaching 10 years, anytime you're in a brand new school, it kind of feels like your first year all over again. So that is also kind of an adventure. But I was trained a classical pianist. So that was where my musical kind of expertise came from. And I grew up in Oklahoma and then went to study my undergrad at the University of Cincinnati Conservatory of Music. And that's when I first got introduced to Orff Schulwerk from Renee Boyer, who is a professor and a well-regarded Orff Schulwerk practitioner. And that's kind of when I realized, well, actually, this elementary music seems really fun as and inspiring, as well as can have a lot of process and take a lot of refining to kind of be skilled at, which is not necessarily something I think I first thought of when you think of elementary music. Mm-hmm. So that's when I really realized this actually can be a very philosophical aspect of my teaching that I really love. Not to mention, I just love working with kids too. So working with, preschoolers and kindergartners brings such a smile to someone's face. And I think that's when I realized this was kind of the journey that I was excited to embark upon. So yeah, that's a little bit about me. And now I've kind of learned more about movement and responsive classroom through some, trainings and experiences that I've been fortunate to kind of run into. And then have made a lot of those connections with Orff Schulwerk as well as the elementary classroom. And that's kind of what led us to this conversation today.
Yes, I'm so excited to talk to you. Okay, so first of all, two things you just said. I'm also from Oklahoma, and I'm also a classically trained pianist. So when you said that, I was like, wait, what? But that's why I love meeting people and meeting music teachers, right? Because you always find something out that's just like, I mean, we could have been at a piano competition back in the day at the same time. That's so
it's possible. I mean, Oklahoma is not that big of a state. That might have actually happened.
So I'm from Owosso area. So the Tulsa area. Okay. So yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I grew up in Norman.
Okay. Just so totally different parts of the state, but still, you never know. Okay. Well, that's so cool.
I actually went to a piano camp at the University of Tulsa.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I might've been at that one in high school. Okay. Well, wow. That's way off subject, but I had to throw that in there because I was really excited when he said that. Okay. So you just never know when you meet another musician, what their story is.
Okay. Right. Oklahomans are great. So.
Oh yeah. You know. Oh, totally. It really is. It is a great state. And and I think people that have never visited, just like I'm in Arkansas now, you know, they just think we all just drive around in covered wagons and there's nothing wrong with that. But I'm like, no, we have vehicles and we live in houses.
Right. Did I ride a horse to school? I've been asked that before. No, actually.
Yeah. So there are cowboys, but you know, it's diversified too. Okay. So you told us a little bit about loving to teach, you know, music to kids, but I would love to, for you to tell us a little bit more about that. What is, if you could pinpoint one thing, or it can be more than one thing, about why do you love teaching music to kids so much? What do you think that would be?
Probably the creativity that they show, the imagination that they're excited to experience in the classroom. And I think that's a big part of my teaching. It's definitely part of the Orchestral Work philosophy, which is that the students kind of make the choices and they can be the guide in the classroom and the teacher is the facilitator. So oftentimes my lessons may not go at all according to kind of how I envisioned them, because all of a sudden the students come up with an idea that may or may not be where I was thinking the lesson would take us. And then all of a sudden we say, well, let's try it. And the students always want to try it. And too often a teacher can say, well, that's not what I was thinking. But I think it's actually it's a better choice to encourage the students to be creative. And maybe they'll find out that sometimes we had ideas that may not have been the best ideas. And that's fine too. But we then get to explore them and the students can understand that there really isn't necessarily a wrong answer, just, you know, different pathways that we can take. So that's definitely one of my favorite things about kids' spirit that as adults too often we lose sight of, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes the kids have the best ideas, like things they'll say or ideas they come up with in your music room that you've never even thought of. And you're like, why did I not think of that? That's actually a really great idea.
Right. You're like, I'm going to teach that to my kids every time I see them now.
Yes, exactly. Okay. So I am really excited to dive in and talk about the responsive classroom. A lot of teachers listening know what that is, but there's also probably some listening that do not know, and that's totally fine if you fall in that area. But I would love for you to just start out by telling us, what is the responsive classroom?
Sure. A responsive classroom is an approach to elementary classroom management that was first developed by a group of teachers actually in the 1980s. And it was based on research that of how students are most effective and how teachers can be most effective, and the idea that a classroom community is essential to that. Responsive classroom recognizes that the social curriculum of how students learn is just as important as the content or the academic curriculum of what the students are learning. So there are some guiding principles that really emphasize that you need to get to know each child individually. And you need to know where the student is coming from, whether that means culture or their family background or what they're experiencing outside the classroom, as well as encouraging things like cooperation and empathy. Definitely a lot of the aspects of that, like social, emotional part of who our students are. And responsive classroom also recognizes that research shows that when students feel that they're in both a safe space, as well as a space that has like routines and procedures, that they're going to be more effective learners, and that they can take the aspects of that kind of like fear or flight, that's not a part of their experience in the classroom. Therefore, they can have a higher emphasis on risk-taking and actually like taking those challenges a little bit further. And so that's kind of like the research side of it. And then what that leads toward is kind of a place where teachers set clear procedures, but also like encourage students to kind of identify what the rules of a classroom would be themselves, rather than the teacher kind of imparting it upon them. Mm-hmm. And then letting students make their own choices in the classroom through kind of these broader projects where then students can maybe make the specific content choices, and then also giving students a lot of chances to work together in different interactive learning structures. So they have chances to work with different students in the classroom, as well as kind of decide how they're going to share out their knowledge. So that's a little bit of like a broad overview of what a classroom might be. But yeah, I've really seen a big difference when I've taken kind of those principles and put them into my classroom on the impact of on student behavior. Because I think we all know as teachers, when we only, especially as music teachers, when we only see the kids a couple times a week, it can be hard to build those relationships. What that often leads toward is challenges with misbehavior. Mm-hmm. So how can we get the students to really focus on being learners and working with each other, as opposed to us constantly addressing classroom management problems?
Yeah.
So that's been a big impact for me.
Oh, I'm sure. And I know classroom management is one of the toughest things of teaching. And like you said, especially for elementary music teachers or any music teachers who see their students a limited amount of time. Are there concrete examples you can give for, I know that's hard to break it down for each grade level, but I don't know, let's talk especially about upper elementary, where that's, let's be honest, that's kind of where a lot of the struggle lies. So how does the responsive class, how does that look with your upper elementary students on a typical day? I know every day in the music room is different, but just give us an example.
Absolutely. There's a couple important aspects of responsive classroom that I think any teacher should take away, you know, from this conversation, or what are some things you could implement tomorrow? Mm-hmm. You know, so you're listening to this right now, what could you do tomorrow? And the first would be a consistent routine on how students enter the classroom. So PK through fifth grade, I always have students enter the same way. They follow me in a circle and we're doing some sort of body percussion or mirroring activity while listening to different kinds of music. So this week we're listening to samba music. Last week we listened to blues. The week before we listened to some soul music. So it doesn't necessarily matter the exact kind, except that I think it's important to show students the music from all sorts of different cultures across the world. And then they know after we make the circle together that they're following me silently. And after we make the circle, then there's a message on the board, which is the aspect of responsive classroom called morning meeting. So in a responsive classroom, in the general space, the classroom teacher is going to have like a 20-minute morning meeting where they read a message and they have like a sharing time together and an activity and a reflection. And in the music space, we can't do that because that would take our whole class and then we would have no time to do the rest of our lesson.
Right.
So instead, so I just have like a brief message on the board that just says, you know, welcome fourth grade. Today we will explore the xylophones and, you know, review our speech piece from last time or something. Mm-hmm. And then I might have a question in it, like, what do you remember about how we moved to the xylophones safely from Mr. S? So that's kind of the message that the students have. So I have that routine to start every class period, which sets the students for success. They know exactly what to expect when they're coming in. They can kind of prepare their bodies already. But we've also been practicing it every single time. And sometimes that means that maybe the students come in noisily, and that just means that we walk right back out and we try it again. And that can be hard to remember and reinforce, but it's not necessarily like a punishment. And I'm not mad at the students per se. It's just, I noticed that we came into the classroom unprepared because we were talking as opposed to mirroring the body percussion. So let's practice again. Yeah. And then you practice again and you'll notice 99% of the time, the students snapped into gear and I didn't need to reprimand them. It was just a, let's remember how this works. And then we try it again. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely one big takeaway that I would definitely suggest that teachers try like right away. And then the second one I would maybe suggest that teachers try is something called interactive modeling. And it's a process where a teacher models a proper routine or behavior. So for the upper elementary kids, it's going to be going to the xylophone. So you have the message that says, today we're going to go to the xylophones. And then I will walk over to the xylophone with my hands by my side. I walk to the last xylophone in the row. I sit there, I put my hands in my lap. And I say, what do you notice? And all the fourth graders jump in. They say, well, I noticed you didn't talk. I noticed you didn't touch anything. I noticed you didn't run. I noticed you didn't jump over the instruments. And they'll say all sorts of things that I don't even think of. You know, I noticed you blinked 7 times or something, you know.
The specific stuff, you're like, what?
Right, I don't even know that I did that, but thanks a lot for sharing, right?
That's awesome.
And then a student models it right after that. And we ask, what do you notice again to reinforce that behavior? and then all the students go. And I do that with fourth grade to this day. I did it today. And it might seem like, do we really need to do that with fourth graders? And the answer is yes, we do. And it's definitely a much better choice for a teacher to make as opposed to, here are the five rules we have when we go to the dial phone. So the students may not be listening and they didn't see a model do it. And then when they go, they may or may not be successful. So this way, you have a model as a teacher, you have a great student model, show it. And every time I do it, the students are always successful. Mm-hmm. So that's a big takeaway I would suggest, is just try the interactive modeling, because then the students come up with the rule. You know, I didn't tell them what the rules are. They realized through the model what the expectations are. And they kind of told themselves and shared out what they saw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. I love everything you just said. And I was like nodding my head the whole time, because seriously, it's so good. And the walking your class out and back in, and like, I love that you said it's not a punishment. It's just, they know what you expect. And knowing we're not starting until we're quiet. And so it's, you know, you're not like, we're coming out in the hall and trying this again. You're not mad. You're just, like you said, modeling. No, this is, we're walking out and coming back in. And when I've told certain teachers to do that, through some mentoring things, and I don't want to do that. They use the word, but that's mean. They're going to think I'm mean. They're going to think, no, it's not about that. I think it just takes a little bit of time. For teachers listening to this and you're thinking that is mean or that's too hard for me to do kind of thing.
Sure. Right.
I think it is something out of your comfort zone, because you want your students to like you. And so you're kind of this fine balance of, yes, I need to model behavior and have classroom management. But on the flip side of that, mm-hmm. I want them to like me. So I don't want to be too hard. But I notice, and you can probably attest to this too, do you feel like most of the classroom management issues happen in a classroom where the teacher is not modeling behavior, or there is no, and this is not to make anyone feel bad, not modeling behavior, and they're just kind of teaching over the noise instead of stopping it and trying to come back in the classroom again? Do you see that happen?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, definitely. And if you're talking to students about it, they'll say that those are the challenging classes for them, because they appreciate a teacher who is a good role model, but also holds high expectations for the kids, but kind of shares it in kind of that, exactly what you said, Jessica, like a role model kind of relationship, you know? Mm-hmm. It can be a strong urge to want to be our students' friends. Yeah. And while we want to have a positive relationship with them where they can trust us and they can want to take risks with us and they can want to share it with us, especially if there's anything, you know, important they want to share, they should always feel safe to be able to do so. But at the same time, we want them to see us as, you know, a safe leader and that facilitator that has, you know, that has those modeling and those role model, you know, qualities. And that's important too. And the only thing else I'll say is, yeah, it will be weird. It will be a little uncomfortable the first time a teacher tries that. So if a teacher's listening right now and you try it, it's going to seem, it'll seem a little funny at first. And the kids will question it a little bit first too. Mm. I just encourage a teacher to just show with your body language and with your tone that it's not a mean tone that you're coming from.
Yeah.
That's why I usually use words like I notice, which so I'm just imparting what I saw as opposed to like an emotion quality to it, or let's remember, or who can show us, or we remind ourselves that, which is just these kind of like open sentence starters,
right?
That are a little less, you know, emotional or negative.
I know what you mean.
You can try to, yeah, right. If you can try to keep your language like that, that's my best suggestion to try it out the first time.
This is the 10th time you've come in like this and I'm sick of it. Yeah.
Instead of something like that. You're thinking in your head. Think it in your head, but don't say it out loud.
Exactly. Exactly. I do want to ask you about this. This just popped in my brain, speaking of my head. Mm-hmm. What about those couple of kids who, you know, always are those students who have a hard time buying into anything you're wanting to do in your classroom? Do they respond well to the responsive classroom system? And then, or does it just take them a little bit longer to come around, kind of?
Mm-hmm. I'd say a little bit of both.
Okay.
And responsive classroom really is a model meant to work for 95 to 99% of the students in your space. So we have students that are on behavior plans.
Right.
That responsive classroom model with that intrinsic motivation and these role model skills and modeling doesn't work for everyone. So someone might need that extrinsic motivator, or someone might need that sticker sheet that's on a behavior plan.
Right.
And that's definitely separate from this. And there are some times where the classes take a longer period of time to come along, like you said. And the best advice I can give is just to not give up too easily and to keep practicing. And does that mean that I've had a class before where we had to go out and in almost every time they came? Yeah, I did for maybe the first month, and you feel like you're pulling your hair out. But then the first time that they come in where they actually do it, you're like, I've got this, you know?
Yes.
Finally.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are classes that come along your path that way where you're like, who designed this class, like the students in this class to be put together? Who scheduled this? Like, what is going on?
Mm-hmm. It sure does. And even for someone who's been doing it a while, it happens. It happens still. And we have rough days, and we have days where we don't always make the best choices as teachers. So don't think that just because someone has a lot of training that it still doesn't happen. And it still doesn't cause you frustration. So you just have to not let it show and just keep practicing those routines as much as you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And give yourself lots of grace, because you're going to have hard days. But tomorrow is always, it always seems to be better if you had a bad day. Yeah. Okay, so let's switch gears a little bit. I also want to talk to you about movement. Totally different subject, but when we talked about what to talk about on this podcast, I knew I wanted to pick your brain about both of these subjects. So with movement, I know you love to teach movement and you teach this at several workshops. So what are your favorite ways to use movement with your students or to teach movement activities to other teachers?
I love moving and I love dancing. And I will just first off say that I'm not a professional dancer. You know, like I said, my training was definitely in music, but I've realized the value that movement and dance plays in the classroom. And that's part of my orchestral work training. And I just said, like, myself comes to life through dance, you know, and my being just feels much more connected. And I can only imagine, and I see it in the students' faces, that when they move too, that they just get so much excitement with their body. So this is something they never get to do in any other space, you know, in the whole school day. So I definitely encourage teachers, even if movement seems like this foreign thing, it really isn't. And you can make it happen successfully in your classroom, and your students are going to be so thrilled to try it out. What does movement look like in my space? It definitely varies, but I'd say kind of mostly splits into two categories, which is like the folk dance side or world dance, where we're teaching kind of a slightly prescriptive dance that goes along with recorded music or instruments or something like that. And then you have the creative movement, which is letting the student, you know, giving some parameters for students to make their own choices, you know, and whether it leads to just very simple things in PK and K up to like smaller choreographies and movement sentences with our older students, can look like a lot of things. So first, if we dive into the folk dance side, and often that's where teachers feel a little more comfortable because it's something that's set. Some suggestions I would give would be, before you ever teach a dance, you need to make sure that you can dance it really well.
Yeah.
So start with something simple, of course, maybe some like the Chimes of Dunkirk book by the New England Dancing Masters, or you can even find things in like the Spotlight of Music books whatever kind of some resources you have, they have folk dances in them. What you should do is try with recorded music by yourself and make sure you can do it a bunch of times without any hesitation, because that way, when you're trying with the students, you're the leader. And oftentimes one avenue to teaching a dance is just to start doing the dance from the beginning, and students will slowly catch on. So if that's a circle dance, that can be a really successful way to do it.
Yeah.
Another way, if you're in a long way set, perhaps might be a scaffolding kind of way to do the dance. So I will show the first part. So maybe I'm walking in and out and I'll show it. And then the students echo me just like they would echo a rhythmic speech piece or something like that. When I do that, though, I usually just use sound as opposed to counting, because students are going to feel the phrase lengths in these kind of like sound structures, as opposed to when we go to middle school and high school, then we start counting in band or orchestra or whatever. And we as adults think that counting is really helpful. But actually for our students, it's not that helpful and it can throw them off quite a bit. So instead, I'll just make a few sounds. Like it might sound like this. And that meant that the students went in, stopped, out, stopped. And I'll just make those sounds. They'll echo me with those sounds, and then we'll keep going through each of the next steps and scaffold it on. And so then I would teach the next step and I would layer those two steps together. So, and then layer the three steps together and the four steps together. And before you know it, you have a dance, which is great. The last thing I would suggest is that teachers should always feel comfortable modifying a folk dance. So let's say you have a folk dance that has a promenade in it, and this promenade is kind of tricky and the students aren't getting it. Take it out, do something different. Just do a two-hand turn, or just have the students walk in and out a couple of times, or go to the left for 8 beats and loop to the right for 8 beats. And I think some teachers are blown away when I suggest that, and they say, well, that's not the way it's written. That's completely fine. We're we're classically trained, so we think we can give a piece exactly as it is, but instead just make a change that maybe has the same beat structure or phrase length, and the students will have, they're not going to know the difference, except that this is a great dance. So that's kind of like the folk dance side of things. Creative movement wise, start off again with something very simple and start with the lower grades. Oftentimes, if it's the first time you're doing movement, getting the oldest students to jump on the movement train can be a little challenging. So starting with folk dance is best. And then when you're doing creative movement, starting with the younger kids is best, because they're going to jump into whatever you might suggest. One book I love is called First Steps in Teaching Creative Movement.
Yeah.
That's by Mary Joyce. And you can sometimes find it. It's out of print, but you can usually catch it on Amazon or eBay still, which is awesome. And she just suggests a lesson where all that you say is, show me a way to sit, and the students sit. And then you say, show me a different way to sit, and the students show me a different way to sit. And then you show a third way and a fourth way, and all of a sudden the students are making all of these shapes. And creating shapes is a big part of creative movement. And then I might suggest, choose your two favorite shapes and show me the first one and the second one. And then I'll say something like, what if you could melt from the first shape into the second shape? And I'll play the drum and they'll melt from the first one to the second one. And say, what if you could melt back from the second shape to the first shape? So what they're doing then is just kind of experiencing their body in space in a very simple kind of way. And then I might ask them other questions. What if you could show me a way to stand? And then what if you could change from your standing shape to your sitting shape? And then I'll say, well, what if you could take even longer? What if you could do it even faster? Or what if you could find a friend and they could show you their shape and you could learn it? So then all of a sudden they're like looking at their partner and seeing what their hands are doing and their feet are doing and their legs are doing and making these kind of like two sculptures that are mirroring identical to each other. And then they have to grow together into a different shape. But, and then you can start to kind of ask them all sorts of really interesting questions, like how could your fingers be touching the whole time? Or how could your elbows be touching the whole time? Or how could you look at each other in the eye the whole time? Or how could you not look at each other at all while you're trying to do it together? Or all sorts of kind of these kind of thought-provoking questions that just kind of lend to students' curiosity. So that's really what can be really fun about creative movement. And then all of a sudden you're at it, you can have a pretty extensive and challenging little movement piece just by kind of posing these questions that started from having a student sit or having a student stand. And I think that's sometimes what we forget, is that we don't have to have these, you know, complicated choreographies per se. Just start with the student's body and see where that leads you. And then before you know it, the kids will start saying, well, what if we tried this? Or Mr. S, you know, they'll ask me, Mr. S, what if we did it back to back? Or what can we try to make a group of three? Or what if we tried to move from one side of the room to the other while we were doing it? And they'll start asking those questions, which is even more exciting. But yeah, it can be challenging, but that's at least one idea of how to kind of an avenue into creative movement with your students.
Yeah, I love that. I remember taking an ORF workshop, and that was the first time I had learned about creative movement, like you just described it, with moving in shapes and find your partner and do this, you know. And before that, with our limited methods class we took in college, was movement is play music, have the kids move, folk dances, but we didn't really go into the creative movement side of things so much because, like you said, our classically trained brains are like, you have to have music playing and you have to dance, not just where else would the kids do this? This would be the only class they would do this, you know, PE they do. I mean,
absolutely,
you know, some stuff like that. But if we don't give them the opportunity to do creative movement, they're probably not going to learn it anywhere else. But yeah, the first time I was kind of mind blown. I'm like, this is genius, because it's getting the kids, like you said, they start making up their own movements, but they love it. I mean, and it gets them really focused and listening, because they're like, oh, what's she going to say next? Or what's he going to say next? And it really I don't know. I loved it. And I remember the first time I learned about it. And then when I started implementing it with my students, and at first they were looking at me like, what? You want us to what now? So, you want us to form a triangle. But it's just anytime you introduce anything new in your classroom, even back to a responsive classroom, it's just sometimes it's like, you know, it just takes time. And you Absolutely. Have to get comfortable with it, and then your students will get comfortable with it with time.
Mm-hmm. And what's great about what you just said, Jessica, is that you've gone to those workshops where you've gotten training. And what I can suggest to teachers listening is find something where you can go to something that suggests that has creative movement in it, whether it's like a modern dance class, perhaps. There's mm-hmm. a dance school in my neighborhood that sometimes I go to because it's a great way to just be comfortable with my own body. Yes. Another path is just yoga, though. Like, if taking yoga classes made me feel a lot more comfortable with movement mm-hmm. and balance. And even if teachers do that, they might feel a little more at ease, you know, with the idea of movement in their own space. With older kids, yoga can also be awesome, because oftentimes people ask me, well, how do you get the older kids, or especially the boys, because that can be a challenge with movement because it doesn't seem like something that might work for them. Mm-hmm. And if you think of yoga and or the idea of these weight relationships, that's something that really hooks the older kids in. So I'll often have them do kind of like those trust activities mm-hmm. where maybe their feet, two kids are standing with their feet near each other, and they hold each other's arms, and they have to start leaning back and see how far they can lean back, keeping their bodies still and slow, and then pull themselves back up again. And that's kind of that idea of that weight relationship. Which yeah. is an important part of creative movement, but also a really neat activity that these kids are like, oh, wow, this is really fun. And they get really mm-hmm. into it. And then you kind of can start asking these what if questions again. Well, what if you started over here and then you found a way to do your weight relationship, and then you found a way to choose a locomotor word to end on the ground. And then all of a sudden you have a little choreography, but the kids are more excited about it because it has this neat aspect that's kind of this really interesting way that's more physical, that I think is what can often get the older kids interested, is it's not just like a dance. And I won't call it a dance. We'll just say, let's try this part where you have to share this weight with your partner. And they think it's really fun because it gets that physicality into it.
Mm. So it's all about sometimes the way you word things too, like how it comes across to your students. Yes, I love that. So I wanted to, before I move on, I wanted to comment on something you said earlier when you talked about make sure you know the folk dance before you teach it to your students. It made me think of the song Alabama Gal. And the first time I tried to teach this, I mean, I had read the movement, but I did not try it on my own. So mm-hmm. of course, when we got to the peel the banana part, I completely forgot. It's like, wait, what? Hold on. So my students were standing there waiting, looking at me like, I'm like, hold on a minute. I'm pretty sure you go around, and then I'm trying to show them, and they're all looking at me, and then I just of course lost them because they were just at that point like, we don't know what we're supposed to do, you know, you can't have a lot of lag time because that's when you, the kids so that taught me my lesson is not just read through it like you would a lesson plan, but like you said, make sure you really know how to do it before you
yeah
and that was like my wake-up call, like, okay girl, get it together.
It seems like such an obvious thing that if someone listens to, like, well, obviously I would know before I teach it, but just like mm-hmm. you said, and you'd be surprised how many other teachers I've gone to visit that try out something and they're like, well, I guess I didn't really know it super well. And that mm-hmm. and especially when you start to get a little more nervous because your kids are with you and you want to do a good job, you should just know it really, really right. well.
Kids moving in the music room is really important. So I want to ask you, when it comes to movement, we talked about all kinds of different movement in the music room. How do you plan what you're going to do movement wise each time you see your students? Do you try to vary it up a little bit each time?
The short answer is yes.
Right. I know that's like a complicated question.
Right. No, I definitely try to have some sort of movement in every class. Mm-hmm. That can be really hard because maybe there's a lot of other things you want to get to. And we know that we want to have our kids working on their singing, as well as their music literacy, as well as some like history aspects, going to the xylophones and playing recorders and playing on pitch percussion. And it's like, when do you have time for movement? So perhaps movement is just something as in the simple mirroring or body percussion activity that they're following me as when they enter the space. That at least is a good way to get a little bit of movement in. I usually though try to switch back and forth between folk dance and creative movement. So maybe I do at least one or the other. So maybe that time with the class, I'm spending 5 or 10 minutes introducing part of a circle folk dance, but I don't actually teach it all. Mm-hmm. Over the course of two or three lessons is really when the whole dance is taught. Or it might just be, well, I have a little bit of time to do a small creative movement activity, like the example I given earlier, and maybe I just spend 5 minutes on it. Another one I spent 5 minutes on today, I kind of call shapes and movers. And it's very simple. So every student makes a shape in the space. And then one friend becomes a mover, and the mover can go anywhere they want as long as they don't ever physically touch a shape. And so they'll be crawling under legs. They'll be jumping over people that are sitting. They'll be running around them. They'll be making fun shapes around them. And then slowly you add more movers. So maybe you have four movers, and the movers are all going through the space. And this happens in first grade. So they're like 6 years old or so. And it's amazing to see the exciting things that they'll want to do. And then after maybe 30 seconds, I play a chime, and the movers each know to tap a shape. They take the shape's place, and then the shape becomes a mover. So that's a really simple movement game that can teach so much, but is a nice way to just say, you have 5 minutes left in class, pull out one of those little movement games like that. Mm-hmm. Another one I learned from a mentor of mine, she calls it rock tunnels and travelers. So a third of the class is a rock, makes different rocks on the ground, which is just kind of curling yourself in a ball. A third of the class makes a tunnel, so they make some sort of shape so the kids can go under them. And then the other third of the class are the travelers that move around, and they get to just crawl under things and jump over things. It's another similar way to do a kind of a game like that as well. And there's all sorts of games like this in Creative Dance for All Ages, a book by Anne Green Gilbert. Mm-hmm. That is like a great go-to resources. There's another fun game called The Magician and the Zombie, where the magician has a scarf and the zombie just has to follow what the scarf does.
Yeah, so that's so fun.
If the kid throws the scarf on the ground, then the kid that's the zombie has to just fall onto the ground. Or if the scarf starts bouncing, the kid starts jumping. And it's just fun things like that that are great to just fill up a few minutes of time that you might have, but also teach so much ideas with what you can do with your body to the students. Yeah, those are definitely some ways I fill up my class. And I make sure, even if I don't have a larger movement idea in mind, I at least do a snippet of something like that with my kids.
Mm-hmm. So a little bit of movement each time you see them, whether it's a big movement activity or just something simple, like you said, for like 5 minutes, but just getting them moving is the point and the goal, right? So
absolutely.
I love that.
And sometimes you might even do it in the middle of your class because your kids are getting antsy. Mm-hmm. And too often we try to push through it and we say, well, we have so much we need to teach. But I have to find a way to get them together. Well, if you maybe just spend 5 minutes and do a little movement game, and then they'll be back in your corner and you can go back to whatever you're working on.
Mm, I love that. That's a great idea. Okay. So do you have any advice that we have not talked about today? We've talked about so much for music teachers listening before we go.
Oh, goodness, Jessica.
We could be here all day, right?
Right. There's so much I want to say. No. You've probably gotten this advice before, but it would be, in general, just don't give up. Mm. And I think that works really well, both for responsive classroom and for introducing movement into the space, which is that the first time it may not go so well. You might think, well, this isn't for me then, or this doesn't work for my kids. My kids are are different, or I don't have, the skills for this. And that definitely couldn't be further from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I think that all students love what a responsive classroom space can offer. And all students love to move, but there can be some big mindset shifts that are going to happen in both of those situations, depending upon what your classroom space is like and depending upon if the students have ever moved before. So just keep at it, as well as start small. Maybe just say, do something a little movement-wise with kindergarten or first grade, or say, today we're just going to practice our routines, or today I'm going to try to use I notice as a sentence starter, as opposed to I like, because that way it really shifts the attention to the student as opposed to the teacher. Mm-hmm. Make little goals for yourself to follow through on. Yeah. The same thing goes when addressing misbehavior. Responsive Classroom has a great model for how you respond to misbehavior by redirecting a student. And that can be challenging as well. So I even put sentence starters on my desk to remind myself every day, even though this is something I've been doing for years. And so just kind of taking it one bit at a time of saying, well, let me just try to work on this week or this for the month, that would definitely be some advice. Don't bite off more than we can chew, because then we get overwhelmed and it's so easy to get burnout as a teacher.
Yes.
And that would be definitely my main suggestion.
Yeah, I love that. I've loved this whole interview. So it's so awesome to talk to you. For our listeners that would love to connect with you online, where can they find you and how can they connect with you?
Absolutely. There's a lot of different ways because I love connecting with other teachers. And I think that's how you and I connected as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. And I think we just learn so much from each other, especially in music education, because we might be the only music teacher in the building. And so sometimes we often feel a little disconnected from everyone else. So the social media is a great way that we can stay in touch with each other and mm-hmm. offer lessons and ideas and reach out to each other if we have queries or things that we're concerned about or want to know more about. So I have a Facebook page, which is Mr. S. Orff, MisterSorff, as well as that's my Instagram handle. Is the same, Mr. S. Orff. And I post to both of those pages all the time with like lesson ideas or other snippets that teachers can maybe take away. And then I have a web page as well, which is MrSorff.com. Or you can go to MatthewStemsrud.com. They both take you to the same place. And I offer some lesson plans on there, as well as some lesson plan videos that are also connected to my YouTube page. Awesome. Which is also Mr. S. Orff. So I post lesson videos on there where, for example, I might go through the process of how you can teach a xylophone piece to your students. And I'll have a 5 or 10 minute video on YouTube that kind of shows how to do that. Mm-hmm. So those are all different ways that you can learn or connect with me. And then I also just love teachers that reach out with messages. So I have teachers who send me Instagram messages asking questions for more information or just something they want to talk about. And I love connecting because it's also really fun for me. And I'll often learn from the teachers that are reaching out. I'm sure you know that. Yeah. And we're constantly learning. And that's what's great about teaching. I think that teachers are lifelong learners and mm-hmm. they're always excited to keep learning. So I would definitely encourage teachers to reach out at any point if there's anything they want to talk about. And I guess finally is that there is a great book that I was fortunate enough to contribute to called Responsive Classroom for Music, Art, PE, and other special areas.
Oh, yeah.
That is a great resource for music teachers that want to know more about responsive classroom. And you can find it on Amazon or anywhere else. But I can attest that it is a classroom management book that is relevant to music.
because there aren't very many.
Right? It's hard to find them sometimes.
Yes.
But I, you know, they reached out to me and I was able to actually kind of curate some of the ideas and lesson plans that they provide in the book. So they really are something that would happen in the music room as opposed to something that someone else writes that would never happen in our space.
Oh, yeah.
So I could definitely give it a thumbs up. It's a good resource if you're kind of dipping your toes into classroom management.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And all these links will be in the show notes as well. So make sure you check them out. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I've loved
Thanks
this interview. Yeah. And it's been great to talk to you.
Yeah, it's been really fun. So I hope that everyone learns a lot from it, and I look forward to kind of staying in touch.
Thank you so much for listening in to the Elementary Music Teacher Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And while you're there, I would love for you to review the show and leave a rating on iTunes. To find out more about how I can help you gain momentum in your elementary music teaching career, head to thedomesticmusician.com where you'll find free downloads, courses, the blog, and so much more. Continue teaching music and never doubt the impact you're making each and every day in the lives of your students.